One of the services we had was super charismatic. People were falling out on the floor. Somebody falls out in front of a girl and she looks, she pulls everybody back. She's like, somebody call 911. I'm a registered nurse. I can handle it. Everybody just back off. And she thought like the person had fainted from like heat exhaust or something. And had to, like, be like, no, she's fine. You know, everything is cool. This is what happens. And they had to kind of break it down. So I definitely see what you mean when it comes to like. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to my YouTube channel. Today, my guest is somebody who has absolutely challenged me to not only rethink some of my theological points and perspectives, but to also rethink a lot of my political leanings, which you know is a big part of this channel. So without further ado, he's a musician, hip-hop artist. He's also a YouTuber. He talks a lot about theology and things like that. Ruslan, thank you so much for being here, man.
Ruslan. Thanks for having me, man. Give myself the sound effects. What's up, Angel?
It's crazy to hear those sound effects on my channel. It's like one of those, you know, just one of those weird moments where everything's kind of a little surreal, man.
Man, I'm glad to be here, bro. I'm excited to talk to you today.
For sure. So I want to get right in the hot water with you because there's something that I've been wanting to ask you about. And I have commented on your videos. Not so nice in the first place. You know, at first when I was watching your stuff, I was very much into the whole MAGA movement and stuff like that. But as I continued to watch you, it kind of softened me up to that a little bit. So I want to ask you about the Bryson Gray interview you did. Four and a half hours, which, by the way, if you haven't seen it, it's a masterclass in how to have like open communication with somebody that doesn't necessarily want to have a conversation, right? They just kind of want to do talking points. But what was your takeaway from that whole 4.5 hour stream? What was something that you kind of left either learning or disagreeing with? What was that like afterward?
Well, personally, I knew, man, I have to not be in a position where I lose my cool or I'm tired or I kind of go down a rabbit hole that isn't even the heart of the discussion. So I think that what I learned from that is like, man, I gotta not, you know, because there was one point where we went back and forth on like, when Jesus talks about lust, is it applicable to single people or is it only applicable to married people because single people can't commit adultery? But when Jesus said, if you lust in your heart, you've committed adultery. So does that only apply to this? Like, we went down this entire rabbit hole and I was just like, yo, the point of that entire conversation is lust is sinful. Many men struggle with lust. Right. So when you compare that to all the other abominations and sinful things, like it's all filthy in the eyes of God, which is why we need Jesus. Let's not judge those more harshly who sin differently than we do. That's why I was trying to get to the heart of that point. Yeah. But he went on this rabbit hole of like, whoa, can single people commit lust? And then is that adultery when a single person lusts? And I was just like, oh my. So I learned that personally. I think it's very difficult to be in his position. And this is not to sound patronizing, but it's very difficult to be someone that is that successful at catering to a niche, an underserviced niche at that, which is the MAGA hip hop community. And that's a thriving community. It's probably a handful of rappers that are really crushing it there. It's very difficult for someone to be that deep in that niche, have that much success there, and then to have an objective conversation where either he looks like he's just got, so there's zero acknowledgement to a point, or where he could see any nuance outside of his paradigm. Because I think there's a combination of a ton of success, a ton of confirmation bias, a ton of just kind of being detached from anyone else's point of view. And part of that, I think, is because of the success. And I think a part of that is just probably some of his personality. And he, you know, I think Bryson means well. Like, I think he genuinely means well. And I don't think Bryson Gray is the same Bryson Gray 10 years from now or 5 years from now, reading the Bible, getting married, having kids. And I said this to him, reading the Bible regularly, having kids. I don't think he's the same person. I think he's a much more softer, gentler, you know what I mean? So it's also trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. It's like, bro, you're living this out very publicly and odds are you're going to soften on some of these hard stances as you just live life more and meet more people and all that kind of stuff. And it's hard because in the moment, he's popping, he's successful, he's this voice for a lot of Christian MAGA people who are whatever, you know. And so that's what I learned, man. So I learned a lot from it, and I like that dude. Like, I genuinely like him. Like, he's very likable. A lot of those dudes are like Brandon Tatum. They're very likable dudes.
Yeah, it's part
of just when you go down the thread of some of the stuff they believe, it's just like, whoa, like, you're pretty out there theologically, and you're pretty out there with how social interactions work. And but how do you explain that to somebody when it's working?
Yeah, you know? Well, that's one of the things that has happened to me from, like, I was at the Stop the Steal things in D.C. You know, I was very pro-Trump. I got my little MAGA hat back there.
I see. Respect.
But one of the things that I noticed was that there's not really a correlation between being a conservative and being a Christian. There's a lot, there is overlap, but there's not necessarily the foundational beliefs of what you would kind of say is Orthodox Christianity. So when I started kind of discovering that with people like, you know, that are very public, like Bryson or Brandon Tatum, it struck me a little weird. And it made me kind of understand one of the things that I fundamentally disagreed with you on at first, which was being politically agnostic, right? I was like, I think one of my comments was like, oh, I love it when people pretend to be not, or to pretend not to have a bias or something. And that was my big critique. But as I watched your content, you were bringing up point after point of how Christians don't necessarily intersect with conservatism wholeheartedly out of everything, right? There's some overlap. What's your take on the MAGA movement and what's happening to politics now? Because you've been talking a lot about it, and it's been changing a lot of people's minds. And I'd love to just get like a little condensed version of like, where does politics fit into your walk with God?
MAGA is an overcorrection of Obama era politics. Mm. Obama era politics is an overcorrection of Bush. Bush was an overcorrection of Clinton. Mm. So you kind of go further and further to the opposite extreme, right? And if you listen to what Obama campaigned on, and then what he kind of did when he first got in, you know, Obama was against gay marriage. Like, people don't remember that. Like, he was against gay marriage. And then a couple years in, he was like, oh, man, we thought civil unions were going to be enough. I think we got to change. And I don't know if he was driving that culture, that cultural conversation, or he was being impacted by that cultural conversation. Like, I don't know what he actually believed or his beliefs. Did his belief ever change? Same thing with a Hillary. So I think what you're seeing is overcorrections. And it's the same with anything else. There's just going to be more. So the more we overcorrect, the further extreme is going to go. And I think MAGA is just the overflow of that. And when you talk to people from either side, like just regular Trump voters, like, I don't mean like the folks that stormed the Capitol, because you could take that, weaponize it, dismiss people, anyone who voted for Trump. But when you talk to regular Trump voters, when you talk to regular Biden voters, and you get to the heart of like, what do you want? Like, what are we ultimately after? Yeah. And you discover that by and large, the majority of people are after the same things. And a lot of the folks who voted for Obama twice voted for Trump in 2016. And a lot of folks who voted for Trump in 2016 didn't vote for him in 2020. I mean, he lost the white male demographic and gained in every other demographic, which is like crazy to think about, right? Like, this man made huge strides in all these other demographics, but lost a lot of white males. A lot of my white male friends didn't vote for him. Like, registered Republicans who voted for him in 2016 was like, I'm done. I can't. This is too nasty. At least with Biden, we know it's going to go back to business as usual. He doesn't seem too far left, doesn't seem too far on the fringes. He's not on AOC Bernie Sanders energy, but, you know, and they just kind of take a calculated risk. And again, I'm not mad at his policies. I think he had some good policies. I think the way he engaged with some of the overseas tariffs was helpful. I think him trying to lower the corporate tax rate was helpful. I think the platinum plan, which is hilarious that he called it that, like, the platinum plan, because black people like platinum. I don't know if that was that, but I think those were good ideas. Like, that almost like, and I don't want to unpack, you know, open scan of words, but it's like his idea of reparations is like opportunity zones, platinum plan, right? Like, it's very interesting the way he was going about stuff. I think he failed in his rhetoric. I think he can, like, what he got elected for in 2016 is not how you get elected in 2020. Had he softened some of the Black Lives Matter rhetoric, some of the, you know, the pageantry with the police stuff and not really putting any type of, had he got on board with like an 8 can't wait, softened some of his rhetoric on Black Lives Matter, been a bit more delicate with how he handled the pandemic, I think he could have legitimately won more people back to him. the more centrist.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I think that that was one of the most popular criticisms of his 2020 campaign from like top conservative commentators, you know, the Daily Wires of the world. They were pretty much saying he's trying to run the same campaign in 2020 that he was in 2016.
Right. And
I find that fascinating, because it kind of split the people on the right, where some wanted him to just keep going wholeheartedly with that, not back down, continue to, you know, punch back twice as hard, quote unquote. And others were like, hey, play it smart now. You know, you're in the White House now. You have to take a different approach. And I kind of agreed with that, which is why the whole explosion of everything was so, I guess it came as such a shock to me, because I didn't expect it to be so toxic in the area of, well, specifically in the church, but in the area of politics. What do you think happens next? Because now we're swinging back, right? Everything is a overcorrection, as you said earlier. What do you think happens next with either this Biden administration or who comes after? Because so far, what I've seen from Biden hasn't done well, you know, and maybe that's my bias, but
if I'm honest with you, I'm not keeping up with like every single move Biden does. I haven't been impressed. You know, I think he's handling the rollout of the vaccines well, but who knows how much of that he's actually doing versus states versus whatever. But said he wanted to get a bunch of people vaccinated. It seems like people are getting vaccinated. It seems like people, things are opening up. Be interesting how and if he handles inflation, because I think that seems to be coming at some point, right? So just printing more money, which is what the Trump administration done, right? Which is like ironic for a Republican conservative president to just like turn on the money press and send everybody checks, right? Shout out Andrew Yang with the UBI thing. And then it's like, now you got Trump sending everybody checks, and then Biden, of course, followed suit. I will be curious to see how they handled inflation, because inflation, what we're seeing on the East Coast with this like gas surge, it just reminds me a lot of this, with the stuff I remember hearing about the 70s.
Yes.
Where you had a hyperinflation, shortages on gas, all of these different things. Like, if we go back to that place, that's not going to be helpful. And then I think the question with Trump, I think he's going to run again. The question is, are people going to get behind him again, or will there be someone like a governor of Florida?
DeSantis.
Like he seems really interesting. Or The Rock. Like, I think if crazy dreamland, right? Mm-hmm. If The Rock ran as a Republican, which he was a registered Republican in the 80s, spoke at the 2000 Republican convention. If The Rock ran as a Republican, that's a game changer. You know what I'm saying? Voted for Biden in 2020, runs as a Republican, and was a registered Republican, and spoke at the convention in the year 2000. And he's in Florida. He's a Florida guy, right? So I think that would be really interesting. So I think there's just so many ways this entire thing could go. And it really just depends, like, is the Republican Party going to stay the party of Trump, or are they going to evolve? I hope that they evolve, because honestly, man, when I look at the policies, outside of social issues, I think they have the better ideas. Like, fiscally speaking, I think they have the better ideas.
You heard it here, guys. Ruslan had the better ideas.
And so it's like there are things that sometimes, yes, we need to conserve certain values or preserve, which is what conservatives believe. Maybe stuff like spending. Maybe stuff like, I don't know, taxes. I'm not for pro-taxes. I'm not big taxes. Mm-hmm. And there's some areas we need to be progressive in and progress in. And I don't have all the answers to those.
Right.
The interesting part on the left is, if you listen to like an Andrew Yang, like the argument goes like this: hey, things are getting cheaper to make, and automation and technology is the new fuel, right? So if Saudi Arabia, if Alaska has fuel as their commodity, this natural commodity then the whole society benefits from. Well, in our context, the commodity is technology and automation. We don't know how fast it'll get, but if things are getting cheaper and easier to make, can the entire population benefit a little bit? And that's kind of like a soft socialism, right?
Right.
Are
you talking about raising minimum wage? Is that
There's a bunch of different ways that could play out. Is that raising minimum wage? Is that something like a UBI? Mm. Does doing a UBI then disincentivize people? Because sending checks was a great idea initially, right? Yeah, send everybody checks, extend unemployment, and then things are opening up and people don't want to go back to work. I just went out to a restaurant and they're just jam slam packed, these poor restaurants, because nobody wants to work, right? And you're just like, oh my gosh, this is so like, was UBI, is UBI a good idea or is it not a good idea? So are we going to then have this massive shift in a restaurant industry? McDonald's, I think Chick-fil-A is paying $16.50 an hour as like an entry position, right? Again, I don't know all of the solutions.
Right.
And I think there's merit on both sides. The things becoming cheaper to make is an interesting idea. Okay, everything is getting cheaper. Clothes are getting cheaper to make. Food is getting cheaper to produce. Technology is getting cheaper to make. So do the folks that make it eat up all the profit, or do we pass down some of the cost savings to the people like Apple is doing? If you look at like what Apple is doing with M1, they cut Intel out. They made the fastest computers ever, and they're passing that savings down to the consumer. Rad, right?
Right.
Do you take some of that and you tax a little bit and then you pass it down to other ways? I don't know, free community. I don't know. That's why I'm politically against it, because I don't know. Like, I don't be knowing what the best way is, because I see people on the side like, well, we don't want absolute Marxism and socialism, because that's going to decentivize technology and innovation and having really dope iPhones and really dope cameras for really cheap. But at the same time, America has never been a pure meritocracy. It's never been strictly like the best win. No, it's, where do you come from? Who are you connected with? What kind of education did you have? It's a lot of variables you don't choose.
Right.
And then a little bit of merit, or a lot of bit of meritocracy, depending on how you want to look at it. So it's tough, man. I don't have the answers to that stuff. I just don't think either side is as malicious as the other side wants to make it out to be.
Right. No, I can definitely see that. You know, being involved, I guess, here in New York with a lot of the local politics and the clubs and the young Republican clubs that I'm in, I will say, like, the America First MAGA thing is being pushed. It's definitely something that people want to continue on. They don't want to give up the party of Trump. And to me, in some respects, I think that's a good thing. In a lot of respects, I do. And there's some areas where I think we need to change. Like you said, the messaging has to change. We have to be able to tap into culture. One of the things that I think, politically speaking, is really important for people on the right to understand is how culture works, right? Because it almost feels like Republicans are detached from culture.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Whereas like more Democrats or the left, they're able to tap into pop culture and all these shows. And it's just so much more accepted because it's palatable for people. And so I think that's one of the big mistakes that people on the right are making. My question to you is the fringes. Right. There's fringes on the right completely, obviously. What do you think of the fringes on the left? What are you seeing come from them? What's the result of them?
The result, the easiest way we could break down the result is absolute equality.
Mm.
It sounds sweet. Like, it's really sweet. It's a good idea. Like, we should just make everybody equal. Right. And again, to which degrees do we have absolute equality, right? You really want absolute equality? Like, you really want LeBron James to make what I make for the same activity? You don't want absolute equality. So I think it's such an obvious fallacy to say absolutely equality. Or to what degree do you want equality? So you don't, you know, Bernie Sanders, the millionaires and the billionaires, and then he becomes a millionaire. And then it's the billionaires.
Right.
So it's okay to be worth $5 million or $10 million, but it's not okay to be worth $100 million or a billion. Like, where do you draw that line? And
right.
Tough part about capitalism is that you it's a game, bro. Money's a game. You can accumulate wealth, and then wealth begets more wealth. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that it's incentivizing to destroy poor people and create inequality. It's just a byproduct of it. Like if I'm tall, it's not that I hate poor people. Excuse me, if I'm tall, it's not that I hate short people. I'm just tall, so I'm naturally better at basketball.
Right.
That sucks. Now, I wish the shorter people would get a shot to also play basketball, and I wish they would get some play time, and maybe they got to be in a different division of the rec league to get a shot. Maybe they got to be JV for a while, and I would want them to get a shot, because sure, people can't make it, but that's what I'm saying. Like, so wealth then begets wealth. So if you come from a wealthy family, and you know how money works, and I mean, shoot, parking your money in a Robinhood account will generate you way more money than inflation, usually, you know? So if you just understand that, really basic math. Take $1 million, park it in put it all in AT&T, get a 7% guaranteed dividend every year. That's $70,000. That's the average person. If you could accumulate $1 million, you can literally, considering our entire economy doesn't fall apart and you know, AT&T doesn't go bankrupt, you can literally sustain yourself indefinitely once you have $1 million.
Right.
That's kind of wild to think about. Like, that's kind of really crazy. Think about it. Average income in America is about $75,000. So when you factor that in and you go, well, is that set up for poor people to fail, or is that just the byproduct of what capitalism is, which is money begets what wealth begets wealth. You build more wealth, you contain it. So the fringes on the left, there's going to be absolute equality, which I don't think it's as much of a fringe as we, like, I don't think as many people believe in that as possible. When you really get to it and you would say, no, I don't want to desensitize LeBron James from being great. I don't want to desensitize Apple from being great. I don't want to desensitize people from building fire stuff, you know, at great prices for people in competition. But that becomes the logical fallacy of absolute equality, or I guess what you would call Marxism. Right. And yes, there's no port. Like, I grew up in Soviet Russia. People don't know this about me. I grew up under, you know, Soviet communist Russia. Okay. Yes, we did not have poor people. Like, we did literally, there was no poor people. There was no homeless people, right? The only homeless people were people that were estranged from their families and they were drunks, right? So there was no, there was a safety net for everybody. But what you really just had is an entire society of lower middle class people, and then some elites at the top level that control government and control the economy. So we lined up for food rations. I remember as a kid lining up for food rations. We would get our water ration. We would get a tub of water for a week or a couple of days, and that was all the water we could use because they rationed off water. The food was rationed, right?
Wow.
There was no absolute poverty, but there was no upward mobility. There was no incentive. So what happens? You then get a culture that just wants to survive, and we're just going to turn up and party and escape.
Right.
Because there's no real incentive. There's no self-fulfilling purpose. So if you know folks that come from Soviet Russia, a lot of them are drunks. A lot of them have substance abuse issues. A lot of them don't take care of their bodies. A lot of them got really bad teeth because they just survive in this.
I think of a communist Russia is Gary V.
Yeah. So Gary V is like my dad in that my dad was a hard-bred entrepreneur. He figured out ways to get jeans from this thing and flip them over in this city and just literally operate in a black market society as an entrepreneur, hardbred natural entrepreneur, because he wanted. So we, as a kid, I remember having a VCR. No one else had a VCR. I remember having a color screen TV. No one else had color screen TVs. I remember having reading caviar and like all of these glimpses of luxury that was really bizarre. And my dad was just moving and shaking and making stuff happen. I remember he told me that when we left Russia, he had like an exorbitant amount of American dollars tucked away in our freezer, like thousands of dollars, U.S. dollars tucked away in our freezer that he was trying to figure out how he could finagle to bring over to America. That's how much of a hustler was. So my dad then comes to America, and what happens? He flourishes. He thrives. He lives in a $1 million home. He's killing it. And see, I want that, right? I want people to have, if you got that in you, I want you to create fly stuff and add value and create services for people. That's the logical conclusion of the left, is what happened in Russia.
I find fascinating some of the parts of your channel where you are talking about this kind of stuff, talking about finances and, you know, telling people get out of debt, get your money right, you know, and you reference it as part of your spiritual walk. It's not just get money for money's sake. It's like there's a lot of basic reasons why somebody should be looking to build their life on a solid foundation financially, because the upside is huge and it's way better than the downside. Can you run through that, what you kind of teach on your channel as far as like how that connects to your walk with Christ, right?
When I was 25, I was 23 when I got married. My wife was 21. We both come not from absolute poverty, but poverty. My wife was in a foster care system from 16 to 18. She lived with that same family until we got married. So she was 21. My mom split. I grew up single mother. My dad wasn't really super active in my life. So I made every stupid decision there was to make with money. I bought a car with 0 miles on it because I needed a stable, reliable vehicle. I co-signed on a condo with my mom that I knew at some point when I got married I was going to move out of. And I was then a couple years in, student loans, car note, and we found ourselves in debt and living hand to mouth without a ton of useful skills. Or you know, my wife more so, like, she finished college. We got married. She went right back into this, like, community college program to learn how to become a designer with a degree. Like, she was just willing to just do it and figure it out. I lived with my mom for the first year in that condo I co-signed, which was hell. Literally, my mother's an alcoholic. I'm fairly open about that. And she's doing better now. But, oh, my gosh, it was terrible. So I find myself, like, 23, 24, newlywed, broke. I'm talking broke. Like, we didn't have $1,000 in our account. Like, broke. And somehow we scraped together, had a nice wedding. And I just was like, yo, this is trash. Like, this isn't how I'm supposed to live. And I got all this debt. And then we first discovered Crown Financial. And then we discovered FPU. And we just listened to Dave Ramsey's podcast every day. And in 18 months, we paid out $45,000 of debt. And in that 18 months, I got sued for this HOA that my mom let go. I had moved out. She had moved out, but she never paid the HOA. She never paid the mortgage. I got sued for that HOA. They levied our accounts. So we had paid rent one day. We wake up and, like, my wife calls me, like, our accounts are completely emptied out. We had, like, maybe $3,000 or $4,000. We had our budget in there. Thankfully, we had just paid rent. And boom, that happens to me. In the process, I start cleaning up my credit, and I discovered that condo I bought went into foreclosure. The first mortgage was foreclosed on. The second mortgage wasn't. So I had $60,000 of debt on my credit,
right,
on top of the $45,000 that I owed.
Jeez.
And so I'm like, yeah, I'm going to have to file for bankruptcy. Like, there's just no way around it. I'm going to have to file for bankruptcy. And I'm listening to Dave Ramsey and knowing how to call. I settled that $60,000 of debt for $1,000. And thankfully, I didn't have to pay taxes on that, because a lot of times if you settle on something, they'll make you pay the taxes on it, like it's income. Or back then they did. I don't know if they changed that law. So long story short, bro, within a matter of 18 months, everything changed. And that day when I woke up to my accounts levied, that was the first day I ever did a feature sale as an artist. And I made $3,000 in like 3 days. I'd never made that much money doing anything before. And I was like, yo, like, and had that not happened, I would have never thought about my music the same way. Had that not happened, I would have never viewed myself as an entrepreneur. And so it's just like all things work for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And now on the other side of that, so we did that. We then went to Paris and Rome and traveled in New York and Atlanta, just did a bunch of traveling. My wife was pregnant. We had 6 months of living expenses. Mm. And we transitioned. I was on staff at my church at the time after we had Levi, which was about 6-7 months old. I just felt like it was time to potentially move on. And I called my wife on tour, not making a ton of money, but like enough money. And she was the one that was like, I was like, yo, you think we should pray about me putting, you know, me potentially leaving the church? Because this is like a lot. I'm traveling a lot. This doesn't make sense. And she's just like, I don't think there's anything we need to pray about. I think you need to come home and put in your 2-week notice. Wow. This is a stay-at-home mom with a 6-month-old telling me I need to quit my job, my stable job at a church, and go be a full-time rapper. Wow. You know what I'm saying? So these ideas changed everything. And it wasn't because she was just like this faith warrior. I mean, she is. But it's because we had 6 months in the bank. Because our overhead was $2,300 a month. Our burn rate was nothing. And right. I knew, okay, at the very least, I could survive for 6 months. If I have to go work for Uber, I will. So I registered for Uber. But by the grace of God, we did that. A year later, we closed a 6-figure deal with Interscope Records. You know what I'm saying? I moved on from that situation. I transitioned into doing my own thing, doing YouTube, and, you know, built multiple 6-figure business that I'm hoping to scale to a 7-figure business as a completely independent musician, YouTuber, you know what I mean? And just building up my catalog. These ideas, completely changed everything. And it's the idea of like, yo, reduce your burn rate so you're not over here needing to make $5,000 a month, right? If you can, you live off of $1,500-$2,000 a month. Can you just live off of rent, food, cell phone? That's it. That's really all you need. Transportation, right? You don't need a lot of stuff. Can you decrease your burn rate? Can you develop useful skills and scarce skills that everybody can't do? Everybody can't do video. Everybody doesn't understand TikTok. Everybody doesn't understand marketing. Everybody doesn't understand Facebook ads. Those are still very scarce skills. Can you do that? Because if you could do that, you could make more money doing that for someone else, like I did working at my church, make more money doing that for someone else, a business, and practice on someone else's business, get paid for it.
Yeah.
And then on the side, build your own thing. And when your own thing builds up, you can jump over and do your own thing. Those skills can always be used. You could always go back in the marketplace. Like if I needed to make $10,000 this month, something came up. I need 10 grand. I could scrape together 10 grand. I know what businesses, I know who I could help. I know I can get a couple clients, flip a couple video jobs, flip a couple marketing jobs, flip some Facebook ads. I could do that with the skills. Forget my actual businesses. The skills are huge, right? And I think that's huge, man. So it's like debt-free, reduce your income, and develop useful, scarce skills that are needed in the marketplace that not everybody can do. Coding, I don't know how to code, but I'm saying coding is a scarce skill, right? And so, yeah, so, and here's the deal. That message is transcendent of political ideology.
Absolutely.
Whether you're like liberal or progressive, conservative, Christian, those ideas, everybody needs those ideas. Everybody needs to think through that. And it's in the people's self-interest to walk through that.
There's, I guess, a critique I have of, I guess, the church at large sometimes when it comes to finances, because what I hear a lot of, and what I used to hear a lot of in my earlier 20s, which kind of made me feel guilty about wanting to pursue entrepreneurship and wanting to get, you know, I guess, a sustainable future and be financially free, was this idea of like, just kind of let go and let God, right? Mm-hmm. Just, you know, wait on God, wait on his sovereignty, wait on his timing, and eventually you'll have your time, you'll have your place, you'll know what he wants you to do. And I always found those ideas a little bit toxic, for lack of a better word. What's your take on that? Do you see that at all? And if not, what would you say to somebody who does feel like guilty for wanting to pursue a good career and have money in the bank and all that stuff?
I think those ideas, again, they sound good. It's like, right. It's like the whole equal outcome situation, right? Like, it sounds cool. And then you really like, okay, let's pull on that thread, you know, and let's think through that. And it, and they're not, I refer to them as, there's a couple different places they're coming from, but I think they ultimately land at this kind of poverty gospel mentality. I think some of that is influenced by our view of the material in the physical world, which is influenced by Gnosticism. Gnosticism views that ultimate enlightenment, the things you know, is how you grow closer to God, not the things you do. And Gnosticism also views the physical man, the material world, the physical world as evil and as ultimately depraved, utterly depraved. You know what I mean? This whole thing. So I think it's a misunderstanding of the gospel. And that Jesus came to a material, physical world. It's, you know, and then he prayed, like, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It's a misunderstanding of Matthew 25 when Jesus tells us the parable of the talents and then says the very next parable after that, which I think is a congruent thought, is into the parable of the least of these, which is, you fed me when I had no food, you clothed me when I was naked, you visited me in prison. And the part that we always miss is like, well, how do you do that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I don't know anybody that's living paycheck to paycheck, hand to mouth, struggling, that's like feeding people, clothing people, and visiting people in prison. Even a Mother Teresa, even someone that's like take a vow of poverty, someone is still funding the practical resources. If a business is donating clothes, someone paid to get that clothes made. Maybe they made it at cost and the business took an L on it. Or a soup kitchen. Someone's paying for that. Some charity, someone's paying for that food. Someone's paying for that. Those clothes, someone's paying for your time to be able to go and take a day off and go visit somebody in prison. A lot of folks, like, they, it's like, yeah, I just want to live a meek. Yeah, when was the last time you visited somebody in prison? It's not something you can do in an hour. It's an all-day thing. Yeah. I've done it a lot. I got friends, you know what I mean, that spent the majority of their adult life in prison. You don't just, it's not just like, I'm just going to pull up and go see the homie in jail. Like, no, you got to stop and go, you know, so what does that, well, you need flexibility in your schedule. And it's, again, it's packaged on the back of the parable of the talents. And people say, well, the parable of the talents, that's about spiritual things. It's about heaven. And again, it's just an over-spiritualization of everything. It was like, well, man, talent was money. He was talking about physical money. Now, we could interpret that as it's about physical things, but I think it's also about spiritual things, but I think it's about the physical things we do that matter in the spiritual sense. Taking care of people, blessing people, caring for people, taking care of your own family. And, dude, the more I thought about these things, it's like, I don't think everybody needs to be rich, but I think everybody can do substantially better than they're doing.
Right.
I think everybody can earn more and ultimately help more. Like, if you truly care about people, I don't think the solution is let me vote in Bernie Sanders, right, who's going to redistribute our wealth and take from the billionaires and give it to the government, who's wildly efficient and effective at doing what exactly? I don't mean to go on a tangent. California's crushing it with this vaccine rollout. You know what California did? They hired Blue Cross to do the vaccine rollout. The government in California knew that they were going to botch the rollout, so they hired a private company to do it for them. I don't think government's very efficient at doing anything. So why would I want the government to do it for me? How about I just earn more,
right,
and do it myself? How about I just earn more and take care of people? And maybe if I earn enough, if I'm worth 10, 20, 30, 40 million someday, I'll build charities and I'll build organizations and I'll partner with the San Diego Rescue Mission. I'll partner with, you know, people building wells in Africa and parts of Asia, parts of South America. I don't think people understand how much wealth solves so many problems when you understand that it's a game and it's accumulated. And if you play that game, you don't got to be a hardcore Ruslan entrepreneur. You just play it a little bit. It accumulates and you could sustain yourself and then have extra to bless other people. And yeah, man, so I forgot your question. I'm gonna be completely honest with you. But I think it's so incongruent with what the Proverbs teaches. Yeah. And I think it's incongruent with what the New Testament teaches.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. You nailed it when it comes to saying, like, it's not necessarily, it's an over-spiritualization is what you said, which I totally agree with. And when I was first becoming a Christian, I became a Christian at 22, 32 now. That was one of the biggest hurdles that I had to face, like, growing in my faith. So you're saying you don't want me to pursue success. You don't want me to be motivated towards what I'm going to be like in my 30s and 40s and 50s. Is that what I'm hearing? Am I hearing that correctly? And I would hear different preachers and different pastors, and it would always go back to this kind of, like, wait on God thing, and, you know, just let the Lord guide you, and this really spiritual kind of, like, you know, people speaking words into my life about different things that were contradicting each other. And so that kind of put me in a place where I was like, I need to research on my own. And I just kind of, like, turned everything off, started reading more of the word, and also listen.
Where are you based? You're based in New York. What kind of church was this? I'm just curious.
Jersey. So I got saved at a borderline Pentecostal, kind of creeping into charismatic church. I'm still there. But the church has changed drastically since I went. Like, my first service, pastors were laying hands on people, everybody's falling out. This is, like, before the preaching, you know. And then nowadays it's a lot more structured. There's a lot more nuance when it comes to theology and stuff. But that was a huge struggle for me back then. And it was very, very charismatic, very spirit-led. And I do see a place for that, but, like, one of the things that kind of switched my mind when it comes to your content was your phrase, I'm charismatic with a seatbelt. It's like, I thought I had to live up to this spiritual ascension that everybody else was going on with, being able to hear from God and speak words. I didn't think that I was doing a good enough job as a Christian. It took me a lot to get away from that and say, you know what? I don't have to be that. I don't have to be my pastor, be my leaders. I can be myself and still be a Christian, you know?
That's dope. You said Jersey City or what part of Jersey?
Suburbs. So I'm in Lodi. I'll probably.
But you're near the city, right? You're near New York.
Yeah, I'm like 15 minutes out.
Yeah, that's dope. I love that part of the country, man. Jersey City, Newark. Obviously New York City. I think that, man. And that's, you know, there's a degree of what is most beneficial in these settings, whether that's church, whether that's, you know, personal relationship with Jesus. And I feel like a lot of times there's nothing wrong with being charismatic or wanting God to move in a physical way or spirit, you know, in the moment. It's just, that has to be submitted to order. It has to be submitted to structure. And in my opinion, I think the churches that do it well have a degree of structure. They, like my buddy, Chris Durso has a church out in Queens, and they are Pentecostal, you know, but there's an order to it. There's some degree of normalcy. There's some degree of order to it. And I think there's a balance that people can find in that, where you can be charismatic and in your worship, but if the person that's never stepped foot in a church walks in, they don't walk into the twilight zone And it's like, what is going on here? This is interesting, you know?
But a little anecdote, one of the services we had was super charismatic. People were falling out on the floor. Somebody falls out in front of a girl, and she looks, she pulls everybody back. She's like, somebody call 911. I'm a registered nurse. I can handle it. Everybody just back off. And she thought, like, the person had fainted from, like, heat exhaust or something. And, be like, no, she's fine. You know, everything is cool. This is what happens. And they had to kind of break it down. So I definitely see what you mean when it comes to, like...
Poor nurse lady, she's there for first and second time. That's funny.
She jumped into action, and that's why I think it's like really healthy for people to watch stuff like what you're doing and Mike Winger, man. Mike Winger's a gangster.
I love Mike Winger.
Just like being able to understand that it's not so rigid. Like, yes, theology, there are correct things you have to believe about Christianity, but it's not so rigid to the point where it's like you don't have the Holy Spirit or you can't speak in tongues, you're not saved. You know, there's all these different denominations with these super rigid lines, and I don't have to ascribe to any of them necessarily. And that was really freeing for me, because I was going through like, am I Calvinist? Am I Arminian? Am I, you know, Reformed? Whatever, whatever.
Let me ask you this. I think a lot of that, the binary thinking, the tribalism, is what I would say, Seth Godin, I think, would call it our lizard brain, right? The secular definition is like your unevolved brain, like your primal, I am amongst my people, I'm amongst my tribe, right? Whether that's, you know, in America, we would assume that there's race to that, but you go to parts of Africa and there's African ethnicities that are different. Folks from Ethiopia are different than folks from Congo. Folks from Congo are different, right? So there's like this separation in amongst just people of the quote unquote same race. But it Seth Godin would say it's our tribalism. It's our lizard brain. It's the unevolved part. It's the secular word of that, right? And that's not me like co-signing evolution or anything like that. But that's how the world would describe it. And then I would say, in Christianity, we probably say that's our depravity. That's our sinfulness. That's our sin of partiality, right? Do you think as we continue growing, evolving, having dialogue, technology allows us to sit, you're in Jersey, I'm in California, we're talking about these different ideas, and then you understand that, okay, food is getting cheaper to make, technology is getting cheaper to make. I think housing is going to be the next thing, by the way. I don't know if you've ever looked into 3D printed houses. They're printing them all over South America right now, like in the slums. So these folks are printing you a full-on 3D printed house for like $4,000 or $5,000. And I'm talking like these look nice, right? And it's starting to hit California. So I'm looking at like prayerfully buying a house next year. I'm looking at it, I'm like, yo, I could buy a brick and mortar house, or I could buy a piece of land and build a brick and mortar house, or I could buy a piece of land and get a 3D printed house. And a 3D printed house looks like the sustainable, cheaper version to go right now. So I think that's gonna be the next thing. So my question to you is, do you think as technology advances, as food gets cheaper to make, do you think we'll, and I don't mean to use the word evolve, but do you think we'll evolve past our lizard brain, past some of these like very tribalistic tendencies where before we were probably hunters and gatherers and groups, my people versus, now it's like you're self-identifying with a tribe. So it's less about race, because you could have Black and Hispanic, Republicans, conservatives, MAGA, you could have white, woke, liberals, CRT, cultural Marxists, right? So it's like you got all these different, and I'm using labels. I'm not saying I'm endorsing any of those titles. I'm saying you can have people of different, but it's still tribalism. It's still my team, your team bad, my team good. You want to ruin America. I want what's best for America. But do you see hope? Sorry, phone call. Do you see hope? Do you see hope for where we could go if this entire thing doesn't implode and massive inflation doesn't happen and we have gas shortages? Like, do you see us? Because I feel like if we look on a macro scale, man, the macro tells us things are getting better.
Right.
Crime is down. Rape is down. Violent murder is down. 2020 had an uptick because of all the, you know, all the craziness. But by and large, society has gotten better. Abortion is down. Some people don't talk a lot about, like, abortion is at historic lows. All of these social ills are getting better. But then there's also the, you know, sexual revolution and divorce, all that kind of stuff. Less people getting married. What do you think? Like, what do you think it'll get better, or do you think this entire thing is going to implode?
So I'm like, I'm a skeptical optimist when it comes to that. I want to believe that things will get better. I do think that technology is playing a big role in that, but I think we have to learn to kind of steward our technology properly. Like the way gatekeepers have changed in the past decade with the advent of the internet, I think has given us the ability to let me across the country talk to you and share things that we would have never been able to share before.
Right.
And so I think because of that, it's a different kind of person that's becoming popular, where I know you did a reaction to a Jordan Peterson video. Somebody like Jordan Peterson would never have the effect that he's had today 20 years ago because of the gatekeepers, you know? So I think it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves. Is the internet going to become another television, or is it going to stay this kind of grassroots thing that just lifts people up based on merit and on the attention of the audience? I would love to see it stay that way, where people are coming up just randomly because of their merit and because of the way that they communicate. That's the ideal, and I think that'll have the best effect on society. But the way it's looking with, you know, places like YouTube and, you know, Facebook that are kind of trying to curate who's on the platform and who's not, it's going to be kind of on the shoulders of whoever creates the platform that's the most free and the most willing to let any voice speak, and then figure out how we're going to steward that and allow it to be the quote unquote new public square where anybody can talk, you know, and we're not just ousting people because we don't like what they say. So I think,
what do you think about the Parler situation post now that they got a new CEO
I think
it's getting back on the platforms, right? They figured out a way to whatever they figured out something. They struck some kind of deal with these platforms to get it back on the App Store and get it on Amazon and the Amazon servers or whatever.
Yeah, they had a server that was owned by a company that Amazon owns. And so that's why they got pulled down. But honestly, I hated Parler to begin with. Like, just the app itself just sucked, like the way it was used. And I think when politics or when ideology gets in front of design and gets in front of innovation and it becomes the main thing, the So places
Hold on. Sound explosion for you. That was a bar. You said when politics and ideology gets in the way of technology and design, then it suffers.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen it before, you know. I mean, it's going to happen with these things like Our Book, which is like a supposedly right-leaning Facebook, essentially. Parler, there's something called Clapper. There's all of these little apps that are popping up, but they're not getting the job done because they're putting their narrative in front of, well, is this an app that's going to work and be fun to use? You know, it's kind of like when somebody makes a corny hip hop song that's like all like Jesus loves me. Yes, he does. It's like, I know what you're trying to do, but you're not succeeding at it very well.
Wow. That is so profound, bro. That is such a bar when technology is or art or whatever is mitigated to. Yeah, man, that's profound. So with that, you said you're a skeptical optimist where you believe things are going.
Yeah.
You're not fully sure if it's going to get better, if society's going to get better or if it's going to get worse.
Yeah. It really depends on the way, we learn to use innovation and we learn to use new technology. If we learn to use it as a supplement to who we are as humans, it'll be great. And I think we'll flourish. But if we try and let it kind of overtake us, be different story, and I think it's going to be to our detriment. But you know, I got you here at 47 minutes, man. I don't want to hold you all day. I know you're a busy guy, but I want to give you the chance to plug everything possible that you're doing, where you're at, where you're going, where people can find you, because I think you are an absolute resource to anybody that's watching my content.
Appreciate that, man. My YouTube, Ruslan, on Ruslan KD on YouTube. Obviously, I'm on Instagram. I just launched my first live streaming course called MasterYouTubeLive.com. My channel has grown by 65,000 subscribers in the last 6 months, which is nuts. And so what I did is, because I want to see more Christian creators, more just reasonable voices on the platform, I put together a course on basically my entire system that allows me to not just touch the algorithm, but frequently touch the algorithm and how I kind of landed on that. And so there's a free training and there's a free stream called like how to, disruptive value, how Meet Kevin, Nick D, and Cardi B like grew their audience. Like, so there's like a free stream of that that they could watch, or they could just go check out the actual course, maybe do the free section of the course. And I would say if people that are looking to get into YouTube, I think it's a fertile space. And much like Mike Winger, he wants to see 10,000 Christian YouTubers on a space. You know, I think a lot of Alan Parr, myself, man, we want to see folks really get into this space, because YouTube right now is as close to a meritocracy as you can get if you understand what buttons to push and how to do it. And I love that as an entrepreneur. I love that. And so I would encourage a lot of people. So we've had some, you know, a relatively good amount of success, like Pastor Roy Dockery grew to, you know, 2,000 subscribers rather quick. We've had a couple people grow their audiences, you know, crack that first 1,000 subscribers, crack that first 500 subscribers. My trainer cracked his first 150 subscribers following this system. And so, yeah, so that's available, masteryoutubelive.com. And then they could just always reach out to me on Instagram or on Instagram is usually the easiest way to get a hold of me. I read all of those. I don't respond to all of them anymore, but I do read all my DMs now.
Awesome. And once again, and actually, last thing, I need you to hit up CoffeeZilla, and I need you guys to collab, because
that would be nuts, dude.
Wait for, man.
Yo, I don't know the logical like crossover there, you know, but I just was on one of his streams and sent him like a super chat. I was kind of like testing the waters to see if he had any idea who I was, and he didn't because he butchered my name. So, you know, usually when you're like in someone's chat, they'll see you and be like, oh, snap, it's da-da-da-da, right? And that's always crazy to me, like the fact that like my favorite, like Mike Winger knew who I was, or these folks who knew who I am, right? So with CoffeeZilla, he didn't know who I was. But I do want to, I would love that. I think he's, and by the way, CoffeeZilla, the way we structured this course, the way we marketed this course, my sales page, a lot of that was influenced by CoffeeZilla and, just not selling a BS course to people. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like really saying, first of all, not pricing it in an outlandish way, but also just not selling people a dream. You know what I'm saying? Not selling people like this falsehood of like, you're going to be a YouTuber with 100,000 subscribers overnight. Like, right. No, you know what I'm saying? Or worse, you're going to make a lot of money off of YouTube and have all this flexibility in it. Like I want, and so we kept it a buck with people that's like, yo, this is very hard. But if you do it right, it's so worth it for all the, and the revenue stream. Like I'm not making a ton of money off of the courses yet, but the other revenue streams, the merchandising, the AdSense, the Patreon community, there's a lot of potential revenue streams that you can really diversify your revenue. So you're not just dependent on YouTube AdSense. A lot of that was influenced by me watching CoffeeZilla's critiques of, you know, BS courses, as you would call them. So shout out to CoffeeZilla.
For sure. Hopefully you'll get on his radar as the course continues to become more successful.
Hopefully.
But man, once again, I appreciate you being on here, man. It's been an honor and learned so much. Thanks for your wisdom, bro.
Angel, thank you so much, brother.
All right, talk to you soon.